All right. So my next game, unsurprisingly to listeners of the podcast, is Team Fortress 2.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I love this game. We've talked about it a lot, but...
Yeah. So, is it just the kind of the innumerable interplays between all the different classes?
Yeah, I think that's a part. I think that's a big part of it. Is that for such a simple game? I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's a pretty simple shooter game. I mean, the classes have some differentiation, but
yeah,
but the fact the team makeup makes a big difference. The online play with real people makes a big difference. And, God, you know, I've put 700 hours in the damn game, so it must be doing something right. I do think part of the lure for me is the community that I'm involved with, you know, the people I play yes. with. You know, a bunch of great guys.
You're just playing with random people.
Yeah, I think it probably would have lost its luster a long time ago had I not been playing with the people I do. I'm just playing random pub games. But it really is just kind of the quintessential online shooter. Actually, I guess it's not quintessential in any way, because there's no other game that I'm aware of that's quite like this game, right?
Is that Monday Night Combat?
I've never played Monday Night Combat, so I maybe, you know, my experience may be limited, but you know, like Battlefield Bad Company has a similar...
Okay.
At least if you look at it from a far enough distance, it has a similar sort of... fits in a similar slot in the genre, right? Mm-hmm. But... you know, the fact that it's cartoony and it's kind of insane in the, you know, the hat part and some of the other crazy yeah. add-on stuff that they've added to it just kind of keeps it fresh and fun and lighthearted. The outrageous deaths, you know, when you explode into a pile of Gibbs and it points out your liver and your pancreas. And it's just, it keeps it lighthearted and fun. It keeps it from getting way too serious, like a modern military simulation shooter game. And it's just... you know, it's easy to get in and play, I think, even today. I don't, you know, it's going on to, you know, it's been 2 years since it came out. 3 years, maybe.
Maybe three, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm not entirely sure. It's difficult to keep track of it because they're always updating it.
I do
wonder if that kind of like colours your opinion. I mean, obviously, it rightly does colour your opinion of it.
Yeah, absolutely. If they released it and not never released anything else for it, it probably would have died by now.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been. Would it have been in your top 20?
Nah, probably not.
Because I think as it released, it's a pretty different game now, isn't it?
It is a quite different game from the way it was originally. But I do think that it's still an accessible game, that new people yes. coming in. It's not like a Battlefield Bad Company where I played that game when it first came out and I stopped playing it and now I don't want to ever go back to it because everybody has all the good gear.
Yes. I mean, that is kind of the stupid way of doing it, though, isn't it? Where you
yeah.
play a class and you don't even have the basics of that class to
right.
be able to use, like a medic or whatever. You
right.
don't have to play to unlock the medic ability.
Right. And so, whereas I think this game, they've done such an excellent job, for the most part. There are probably a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, all of the weapons that have come out after the base game was released have been different, but not better. And that's yeah. what kind of keeps it accessible, that somebody new can come in and if you have some decent first-person shooter skills, you can come in and not be at any disadvantage to people who have been playing for a long time,
yeah.
except in terms of a little bit of knowledge over the maps. And the maps are relatively simplistic. They're mm-hmm. not, most of them are not that complicated. One playthrough should be enough to give you a really good sense of where things happen and where, you know, where the drops are and things like that.
You need to go, yeah.
You know, and so I think this kind of is, I wish more games would be like this. Or actually, I guess I'm not more glad more games are like this because I don't have enough time as it is. But that you just really, you know, it's easy, accessible, fun. It's just a lot of fun at the end of the day. It's just a lot of fun.
I was going to say, as your kind of like counterpoint to that, it was like they've actually recently learned to monetize the game incredibly well with the boxes and the unlocks and stuff like that, and the hat trading and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they have, but you know what? I haven't spent any money in this game.
Oh no, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. What I'm saying is, if every game did it, then you'd be a very poor person.
No, not necessarily, because if they did it in a similar way to Team Fortress 2, you don't have to buy anything, right? I've not spent any money beyond buying the actual game itself, which actually I treated as a pack into episode 2, right? So I haven't, you don't have to buy anything at all if you don't want to, because the weapons will, you know, the weapons, you can buy them or they will drop for you, or you can craft them. I mean, there's a lot of the interesting part about the game is that you can get there and get the things that you want for the most part. Again, there's a couple of exclusive pieces of content that you have to buy, but I don't really care about that shit anyway. Oops, crap. Anyway, the kids just left, so the swear light has gone on a little bit, I guess. But there's multiple ways to get what you want out of the game, and so I think they were smart in figuring out how to monetize this. They've been obviously very successful at it, if you read some of the stories that have come out around it. But the bottom line is, you don't have to get into that if you don't want to. Now, I should probably go in and spend a little bit of money in their store, just as a, you know, a game that's giving you 700 hours that you paid.
It's like a tip, isn't it? When you go,
like a tip. Hey, appreciate the effort, guys. Here's $50 or whatever.
Whoa, $50. I'll tell you what. All right, how many hours have we done this podcast? Did you want to tip me?
When we get to 700 hours, we'll talk.
Okay.
So anyway, Team Fortress 2, just there you go. One of my favorite games of all time.
Okay, so kind of counterpointing that, kind of my version of Team Fortress 2, because I think it's that kind of thing is very dependent on the community and of the time it's released and when you're playing the game.
Yep.
So for me, my next game is Quake 3 Arena.
Ah, yes.
So that for me was when it was my first real experience of an online game as well.
Right.
So I was late to the kind of the internet phenomenon. I joined in 2001.
Okay.
So late 2000 or so. And I had a PC which couldn't play Quake 3 Arena, but I played it anyway. And it was amazing that I could play all these different people online. And the game is balanced perfectly. All the weapons work.
Right.
You know, there isn't really a weak weapon as long as you know how to use it and in what situation to use it.
Right.
The maps they released were perfect. There was different strategies and different tactics on different maps.
Right.
And, okay, the game types they released were very bare bones, but at the time they were, you know, enough.
They were a big step forward, actually, if I remember correctly, when that game came out. Because previous to that, you really had
Deathmatch,
and I think there's Captured... I want to remember there's Captured the Flag.
I'm pretty sure that all those were mods.
Mods, you're right. They were mods.
In Quake 2, yeah.
Yep.
So originally Quake 2 released with Deathmatch. I think that was possibly it. And Capture the Flag and Team Deathmatch were all added in later on. Whereas they kind of absorbed them into Quake 3 Arena.
Right.
And the add-on they had, I can't remember what it was called, didn't for me add anything to the game. It was just added up some power-ups and stuff like that, which didn't make the game any better.
Right.
But what really made the game for me, as you said, was the mods. And this is kind of the kind of analogous situation here, whereas it's much harder to make mods these days. So what Valve have done with Team Fortress 2 is that they've made the mods that the community wants. You know, they've added more hats. They've added more purchasing things. They've done events, like the Halloween events. They've done stuff which the community wants. And they've also integrated community maps as well.
Right.
Whereas in the past, it was all up to the community to moderate and to produce this stuff.
Right.
There was a mod company developer called FreeWave. I think they're called FreeWave.
Right. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, and they've been absorbed into a company. It may have been Valve. I can't remember who now. But they made Capture Strike and Capture the Flag, and their version was pretty much the definitive version that was made online. And they standardized the league matches and the league maps that were used, and those maps were brilliant. I mean, I played in the league. I mean, we weren't in the top tier. But we were second or third division for a couple of years.
Right.
And it was the stress and the joy. And it was like playing football or something, or any kind of team sports. You know, it was just brilliant. And the game itself supported that. You know, it was very mod friendly, and John Carmack's always been very mod friendly anyway.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
So you could just stick it in and it slot it in, and you know, once you had the custom UI, it worked. You know, once you had the menu option, it was fine. And that, to me, I mean, I've gone back and played Crate 3. I haven't played it in the last couple of years. But now they've got the online version, they've got the web-based version.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
I did play during the beta, and I haven't gone back since that. So I haven't really got a PC worth playing at the moment. But it's a game where, like Team Fortress 2, well, I don't like Team Fortress 2 because I don't like the randomness of elements of it. I don't like the Uber, but also the crits as well. They're my main dislike. But with Quake 3, you didn't have to be the perfect player. You had to know everything. So you could be the best shot on the map, but you wouldn't win.
Right.
Because you didn't know the tactics of the map. You didn't know how to play people against each other. You know, the best players, you know, they would, you know, set people up to fight each other if it was a deathmatch kind of environment. And then they would pick them both off. You know, stuff like that. Yeah, and then there was completely different tactics and different things, playing different types, like 1v1. And the 1v1 scene was deadly. I mean, I got into that for a little bit, and it was, okay, I wasn't great, but I could hold my own in a certain level. But the top players, you would die second after second. They would know all the spawn points in the map. And that's amazing skill.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Those top tier FPS players were just something else, right? I mean, just incredible, incredibly talented people.
And it's just a shame that it was completely unwatchable.
Yeah.
So you know, like things like StarCraft, where you could watch it. There was attempts at that with downloading the recordings of the matches and stuff.
Right.
But depending on how you played, that flicking of the wrist made you sick, or it just meant you couldn't follow what was going on.
Well, and plus, you know, the other thing is. There's so much going on, right, in those games that it's hard to follow where the important things that are happening on the map are. Yeah. Whereas, you know, StarCraft, you can kind of say, okay, here comes the whatever, you know.
And of course, one of the things I found with playing League-wise is that there was usually someone keeping time. They had like a macro or something like that, and they would know when the quad was going in. So, but you wouldn't have access to that as you were watching it.
Right.
So you wouldn't know that.
It's a lot of the strategy. So Quake 3 was probably the last, until I started playing Team Fortress 2, Quake 3 was probably the last first-person shooter I played, at least certainly online. But I played everything up until, and including that. What I found was it moved way too fast compared to Quake 2 and the older id games. And so I think that's, you know, Quake 3 I kind of blame as the game that got me to miss a lot of the online games, you know, from pretty much, you know, 2000 to 2007.
Yeah.
Which means I missed, you know, Counter-Strike, Source, and you know, but there's a bunch of online games that I didn't play because Quake 3 kind of scared me off. You know, I was starting to get older.
I think Counter-Strike is less user newbie-friendly than Quake.
Well, I didn't even try to play it, or Tribes. I never played Tribes. Because that game kind of scared me off. I was getting older, my Twitch skills were diminishing, and I couldn't play at the level that I wanted to play.
Yes, yeah.
And so, you know, when you're frustrated and you, most of the time you spend yourself being disappointed and frustrated at how you play, the game is not any fun. And I played it for a little bit and then I put it down and never really picked it up. The other thing I was really disappointed in Quake 3 Arena was the single player. It was the first game that didn't have any single player at all.
That's right, yeah.
And I really liked the single player campaigns in the other id games, even though they were stupid. They were fun shooting galleries.
Yeah.
You know, when it starts to make a plot in a game like Doom 3, then you know you're in trouble because they don't know how to do a plot. You get monster clauses and crap like that. Whereas if it's just a run and gun, hey, here's a level, go through here. We got a bunch of enemies in here. That's pretty fun.
Yeah, I think I was gonna say I did enjoy Doom 3. I think I'm in the minority.
You are in the minority. It was okay, but it wasn't Doom quality.
Mm.
Because Doom actually turns out to be in my top 10.
Is that your next game? Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it's not my next game, but I think the tie-in is too direct.
I think it works. Yeah.
A lot of the things that you brought out, you know, it's your first online experience. You know, it seems like you got in with a group of guys that you enjoyed playing with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had some competition going on. Doom, when Doom first came out, you know, I had a bunch of guys at work. Now, Doom, internet, especially when it first came out.
Did it have internet? I thought it was just direct connection.
You had to use some third-party tool to get on the internet, like Kali.
Okay.
Kali
No. Never had that access. Literally, my computer skills were non-existent before 1999.
But really, we had a bunch of guys who played at work. We had a big LAN at work, and we would play after hours. And just the ability to get online with other people and play against real people was just a revelation. It was so good. We actually generated, this is back before we had any online support for competition. This was all pure deathmatch, right?
Against everybody else.
Yeah. And we developed a league where you had a teammate. And you had to not shoot your teammate. If you killed your teammate, you lost a point.
Yeah.
And if you killed the other team, you gained a point. And
how did you keep track of it?
We have referees, and we do capture screenshots at the end of the game.
Oh, wow, okay.
To, to the referee. And there were times, so you have 5 minutes. And we had head ladders and tournaments, and man, it was such a good time.
It sounds like it was quite a few of you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we had a lot of guys, and they were really into it. And, you know, we probably had about 8 or 10 teams at the office. And,
wow.
Yeah, so.
That's like an era gone by, isn't it?
It really is an era gone by because it's all manual. I mean, there's nothing on, you know, because the game was just as happy if you shot your teammate as if you shot somebody else.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I was just even thinking, like, the whole, you would not be able to get away with that in normal corporate environment these days.
Probably not. It depends on where you work. I could probably get away with that at my work.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, I mean, it just depends on where you work. I mean, we're working at, I was a small, relatively small satellite office. I don't know. We had about 60, 65 people there.
Okay.
They were all young computer geeks, and a lot of people liked to play games. And that was, it wasn't necessarily encouraged, but it was not, definitely not discouraged by the management at the time. And for me, and I actually went and played, back and played a little bit of Doom, and it looks butt ugly.
Yes.
But it's, for me, it's so simplistic.
It's like checkers compared to chess.
It really is. It really is. It's checkers to chess. I can't come up with a better analogy than that. It's so simplistic. It boils everything down to you with a gun shooting other things in the face. Period. End of story.
And the thing as well, considering the ability of the hardware and the programming at the time, the feedback from that is amazing.
Weapons, it really is.
I mean, compared with many modern games, some people sometimes complain about the weapons feeling flat or like pea shooters. Right. Weapons in Doom, when you shoot a shotgun in someone's face, they fly away, and you get a nice meaty sound.
It's very satisfying. I mean, audibly and visually, it's very satisfying. You feel like you've actually shot a double barrel shotgun at somebody's face. And you know, you start out with a pistol. Pistol is not very good at all. And the rocket launcher feels like a big beefy rocket launcher.
And the thing as well is, it's great because it even feels like it takes a second to fire. Like if you take a normal rocket launcher in the world and you hit your trigger, it does take that split second for it to, you know, razz up its rocket and fly out. It's not very long, but that is kind of mimicked in the game.
There is a little bit of a delay. Yeah, absolutely. They did just such a fantastic job. And then it was the way the game was put together, and now I'm kind of talking about the single-player game. The way the game itself was put together, it's just a stupid run-and-gun, balls-to-the-wall, fast-as-you-can game. But the way they put the enemies in strategic locations made it very tense.
Yeah.
So you wanted to run through and shoot things as fast as you could, but you never knew. Well, after a while, you knew because they're always in the same place.
Yeah.
But when it was first released, you were never sure when you run into this darkened room with a flickering light that always had the thing that you were looking for underneath it. Where all those little imps were. Yeah, you're looking for the key cards, right?
Yeah.
And you never knew when the imps are going to be popping out behind things and fireball you to death,
or
right?
Spawning in, yeah.
Or spawning in, or you know, and so it was a very tense game.
I think the sound. I mean, talking about the sounds again. Because the way they were technologically limited really badly, they couldn't even put floors above each other. And so that led to really interesting workarounds for the map layouts. But also, so one of the kind of restraints from that was that when they wanted to warp enemies in, they didn't come from nowhere. They were in a room somewhere in the map.
Yeah.
And quite often they put that room, it was completely inaccessible. If you weren't in no clip, you could find where it was. They would put those enemies near where you were. So sometimes you would hear the groaning, the and you'd be freaked out because you would know something was coming or something was near, but you wouldn't know where they were coming from or what.
Right. And so so you had these crazy ambient sounds going on all over you, and you never knew. And it really did kind of give you this sense of all hell is breaking loose. You sense that there's danger on every side, even if not necessarily there's a lot of danger on every side. But it was just such a great game. And, you know, even back then, you know, so mod friendly. I mean, had guys, and I went through a little phase of this too, you know, design your own levels. And, you know, the tools were simple enough that even a dumbass like me could get into them and make something that was not great by any means, but not horrible at all. And so the ability to play, you know, some custom maps really gave that game some legs that probably otherwise wouldn't once you play through the single player match. And then, you know, the online stuff, I was very lucky in the sense that the place that I was, you know, had a big LAN, was highly networked.
Yes, yeah.
And so, you know, most people would not have that experience. They would just buy and play the single player game and because you couldn't really get online.
But even then, it was still like the definitive game, really. You know, it was like Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah. And
to PC gaming, what Super Mario Brothers was to console gaming.
Right.
It's assured quality and also reliability, you know what I mean? And that was the thing that, after the crash, that's what Super Mario Brothers did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, I'm going on to the next game. It's another first person shooter, actually. Got a bit of a glut here. it was Far Cry.
Ah, yes, Far Cry. Good game.
And so for me, it was a big toss-up because Chrome, it's a bit of a less-known game, came out first. And that was my first experience of vast open worlds where you could take your own, well, within limits, you could take your own way to the objective. But Far Cry, I think, it had the AI system. So, you know, it wasn't perfect. And you could change, alter how sensitive they were and stuff, which was quite useful. But, you know, you could go and you could spot out where the enemies were because they had their own ID cards on them and stuff like that. So you'd be able to keep track of them once you'd seen them. But if you hadn't seen them, if you hadn't done your homework, if you hadn't spotted them, they could creep up on you. Hmm. And there was also the fact that if you alerted them, if you didn't take them out strategically, they would all rush to where you were or where you'd been last been spotted. And that was great about the game. It was my first experience of a game where there was a kind of environmental AI that was trying to mimic the real world, which Chrome didn't have. It was Chrome was kind of the hybrid between it was the mid step between Far Cry and something like Quake, you know, where an enemy sees you, comes straight towards you.
Right.
And whereas in Far Cry, you know, enemies would try and sneak up on you, or they would try and find where you were if they lost sight of you and stuff like that. Unfortunately, you know, it did suffer from some minor things like the sniper rockets and stuff like that. Things where the AI would see you from half a map away and then be able to keep track of you. That was the kind of flip side of things. But what they were trying to do is is basically unparalleled in many first-person shooters. Even in Far Cry 2, it wasn't, the AI wasn't quite as astute. It was much more simplified. It was more localized.
Right.
And my kind of perfect game would be something like Far Cry 2, where you have a map you can go and explore, but where you have a limited number of enemies, but maybe they can, you know, call in reinforcements and stuff, and you have to stop them from doing that.
Right. Yeah. I just remember Far Cry 2 being awesome visually. I mean, it's such a beautiful game.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for, it was probably the best looking game of its time. It's probably still one of the better looking games out there.
It still looks really good.
I mean, it really does, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, and like you said, the AI was really good. When you got to a certain point in the game, though, it really kind of died for me.
Yes, once you hit the Trigens, you hit the mutants, the game went off the rails completely. It was like, there's another game I was trying to think of, where they switched enemies from humans who were interesting to aliens. I can't remember what it is now. But it completely changed. And the game seemed to be... And I know what it was. It was by the same developers. It was the one with the super suits. Oh, what was it called?
Crisis?
Crisis. That was the one. So the game was tuned to play against the aliens. So your abilities worked much better against the aliens, whereas against the humans, they were pretty useless. So your super suit couldn't take more than a couple of hits of a gun, even though there was supposed to be body armor and stuff on it.
Right.
Whereas it was the opposite problem in Far Cry, where you enjoyed the first part with the humans and then didn't enjoy the second part with the Trigens because it wasn't really balanced towards the Trigen side of things.
Right.
So it was quite interesting to compare those two, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have anything to add. I mean, it was too bad because that game was so good up until that point that it just, when you got to that point, it's probably the last third of the game, I would guess. I'm trying to remember back.
I think it's literally about halfway, I think.
Is it about halfway?
Yeah, because there are quite a few long levels where you're going through the mines and stuff like that.
You've got a mixture of,
and I think actually what would have been better was if they had kind of kept the human elements and had the Trigens as a very minor faction, like the occasional encounter.
Right.
Because they were much more scary to face.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing that game kind of suffered is when it went into the mines.
Oh yeah, it was boring.
It really, you know, you lose a lot of that visual splendor that you have on the island, right? I mean, the game still looked okay, but you're not playing Far Cry to be in a mine. I mean,
no.
You'll play Doom or something like that, right?
The tactical options just fell away. It became a corridor shooter, and corridor shooters are basically boring.
Yeah, I think so. I agree totally. It's too bad that it went that way. But Far Cry was a fantastic game. I should go back and see if I can dig that up.
Yeah. Okay. So take a quick break here, and then after a bit, we'll come back and continue on with the last couple of games.
Sounds great.
Yes, so welcome back. So after a quick break, we've only got a couple of games left now. Do you want to go first with your next game?
Yeah, my next game is a really old game. As opposed to all the new games that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think it's quite damning though that we don't have any newish games. I mean, I've played through all the Modern Warfare and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it is too. I think it really kind of speaks volumes about the state of the art or lack thereof.
Well, this is the kind of cultural impact that the going mainstream has had.
Right. So my game, I played on the Commodore 64. My next game on the list.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's Ultima 5. I think you could play it on the PC, but I didn't have a PC when this came out. I love the Ultima series, or I love the first seven Ultima series games. But I love Ultima 5 the most because this is the first game where I really felt like I was in a different world. That the world didn't exist purely for me as a player.
Okay.
But instead was a real living, working world that was going to go on functioning whether I was there or not. And also the world felt vast, especially compared to other games of the time, which were, you know, necessarily, you know, due to limitations of technology, pretty small.
Yes, yes.
When you sat down and you mapped everything out and you look at it and you go, was that it? This game, even though I played Ultima 2, 3, 4, and really the game mechanics and graphics weren't that different between 4 and 5.
Mm.
The landmass, the size of the map that you interacted with was probably, I want to say, 4 times bigger in Ultima 5 than it was in Ultima 4. So one of the really cool things was I already kind of knew, because this series takes place, you know, after Ultima 2, in the same place, Britannia, right? And you keep coming back to Britannia, and you have to fix different problems that the Britannians are having. So you kind of already know where the cities are, and, you know, you have some recurring NPCs, and, you know, there's Lord British, who's the king. And, yeah. And,
Hi.
But the awesome thing about this game is it's just the size of the game map was just so big. Going from one end of the continent to the other took a really long time. I'm probably misremembering it because I was not able to get this game up and running, but it took a long, long time. So it felt very bad. It felt vast. When you're in the forest and you're stuck in this forest, you know, there's a forest area.
Mm.
It was huge, and you were in your line of sight was diminished. So you couldn't see more than, you know, it's a top Ultima up until, and Ultima 5 is probably the last one of this, you know, before it started to change quite a bit.
Mm.
But it's a top down role playing game, old school, you know,
okay,
where you have a little sprite that stands for you and your party. And it occupies a square space on a map. And enemies were sprites, you know, that stood for their whatever was in the monster party.
Could you avoid them, could you? Could you see them before they...
You absolutely could avoid them.
Okay.
Yes. You see them, you can avoid them. If you don't feel like fighting for some reason,
yeah,
then yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And so it became very important to go back to the forest. You couldn't see more than one square outside of, you know, radius of where you were.
Mm.
So you could have monsters all over the place and you couldn't be able to see them. So you could be trying to get back somewhere from a really hard fight, trying to get back to town, and monsters could jump on top of you and, you know, that could be it. You'd be trying to find your save somewhere.
That's pretty cool.
If you remember to make it.
Yeah, I remember that part.
You know, and it's also, you know, the Ultima series has always been kind of a different type of role-playing game. There's always been at least the attempt for some sort of deeper meaning there. You know, like in Ultima 4, the game wasn't really about anything except for you becoming this, what they call the avatar, right? The symbol of all the positive virtues, right? They have virtues,
mm-hmm,
that the world wants to embody. You become the symbol for the entire people. In Ultima 5, it's really about a kind of a theme that goes on through some of the rest of the games. It becomes about power and how power corrupts and how good ideas taken a little too far can be as bad as bad ideals.
Yes, yeah.
And so in this game, Lord British, he was an adventurer at one time. He decides to go off on an expedition and he gets lost. And his, you know, second in command takes the throne and he starts to subvert the virtues, right? What you stand for.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of become an outlaw in this land that you kind of, if you played the other game,
oh, so you're,
kind of grown up with.
You're playing the same character then?
Yeah, you play the same character.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's really cool. This is one reason why I love it. The conceit is that you live on Earth and Lord British is from Earth and you go through these portals into Britannia
Ah.
And so you keep visiting, and time flows at different rates, right? That's how they justify...
That sounds exactly like Terry Brooks's Magical Kingdom of Landover series.
Yeah, I guess, from what I've heard. I've never really read it, but... But yeah, I mean, it's not like it's a revolutionary concept, except in video games, it seems like it is.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up revisiting the same land. It just changes over time. And it really has some impact because in a later game, like in Ultima 7, you come back and a long time has passed. And some of the places you've seen are gone. Some of the people that you knew are dead.
Yes, yeah.
There's like litter around this beautiful lake that used to be there. And it's just kind of a slummy, slimy kind of place. And you kind of come in and say, like, what the hell happened? Yeah, it really kind of has emotional impact on you. But Ultima 5, I'm sorry.
So it's kind of like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, isn't it? Sorry, C.S. Lewis's series.
I think that's a good analogy as well. I mean, obviously there's a lot of... a lot of ideas taken from that series of books for this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about a lot, but obviously there's definitely some impact there, no doubt about it. But this game, you're an outlaw. You're trying to find Lord British while dodging, Lord Blackthorn with an E on the end because we're all fake British in this game.
Yeah.
And he's fallen in with these guys called the Shadow Lords, who are bad guys and are kind of twisting what the land is all about. And the underground, there's an underground area that's just huge, right? You're just massive. And you just...
I suppose the thing, it speaks to you as well, but if you hadn't played the previous ones, would this have been in your top 10?
Probably not, to be honest with you. If I had just played this one game and didn't have a lot of the context of the series...
Mm.
It probably would not. I mean,
so is it more fair to say that the Ultima series is this entry? Do you think?
I think so.
It's possible. I think it's possible to because there is a kind of cachet. I don't know if that's the right word to say that certain series build up.
Yes. Yeah. There's a continuity there that players who come back, you have certain expectations that you don't have to have outlined for you.
Uh-huh.
And then the author, right, the developer can play upon those expectations and have a lot more impact upon you as a player because of the way they've changed the world or what's different, the messages that they're trying to send. And Lord British, the guy, right, Richard Garriott, he has some definite thoughts about things, right? I mean, the guy is...
He's very free-thinking, I think.
Yeah. Even in real life, right? So he's trying to get across some of these messages in... these games, and they're able to communicate them much more effectively because they keep going to the same place and altering it in certain ways.
Yes, yeah.
In my top 30 games when I started trying to winnow these games down, I mean, I had Ultima 4 through 7 on my list because each one of them...
brings something new to the table.
They really do. They extend each other in interesting ways, and they are all linked together and make a larger story arc amongst the whole entire game. And I know the story arc was probably not intentional, but if you go back and you look at each one of these things and what each game in itself is trying to say about, the world is a real thing, you kind of do see this sort of arc of overarching themes and ideals that are being, given to the player. And Ultima 5, I feel like, as a game that, gave you a lot of scope and a lot of interesting things to think about, was really, really successful. That's not to say that the other games are any less bad.
It was just that was the kind of the epitome of the art, as it were.
For me, for that era, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the Ultima 6, that was kind of the last game of that sort, of that style. Like, Ultima 6 went with more, you had to kind of play it on the PC because it was mouse-driven, mouse and keyboard-driven.
Yeah.
Whereas, Ultima 5 was a, Commodore 64 with a joystick. And, Ultima 7 was a, pretty, it even looks pretty good. I mean, it looks like Ultima Online in a lot of ways.
Okay, I'm going to do
that. And that sort of graphical style where everything's a, if I remember correctly, left click was to use your hands and right click was to move your feet. And so the series, it kind of evolved over time. And this was probably my favorite of all time just because of the scope of it. Because when you went to Ultima 6, the land felt smaller again.
Yeah.
it wasn't quite as big, and you know, there were some distant horizons and you know, a lot of interesting things to go do. I mean, there were a lot of interesting things to go do, but it's just more compact.
Okay.
And Ultima 7 was even more compact, I felt. So anyway, Ultima 5 is just probably my favorite of that series, and that's my favorite series of all time. So
okay, yeah. Cool. Okay, so
what about you?
My next game is Prince of Persia. Although you could probably say the Prince of Persia series, if we're gonna kind of in relation to the Ultima series, because every entry has its strong and weak points. Although disregarding the Prince of Persia 3D. Because that doesn't exist. It's like Master of Orion 3. They don't exist.
They don't exist.
But
so bad.
The one I actually listed for this list was The Sands of Time, and it's just the game itself is, the story is so well written. It is like the perfect action / love adventure film that could be written. You know what I mean? And the progression of the characters. And that as they intertwine between each other, they play off each other, the hopes, the fears, and the aggression against the situation. It works, and dialogue is intelligent. It flows well. The people who play the prince and Farah, they are able to emote the scenes well. You know, there's no stilted dialogue going on as there is with many games.
Right.
And it's not all butch or anything like it is in Gears of War. These characters are flawed in a very real way, in a real, very, very real sense.
Right.
And you could side with either one, but eventually you end up liking both of them. You know, and the prince, both, the thing that's unusual about the game, in the story sense, is that both characters have progression. In many games, even modern ones, your character or the other ancillary characters don't have a traditional character arc like they do in a book or a play or a movie. You know, they don't learn something, they don't grow. They end up still kind of killing guys for no reason at the end.
Right.
The story moves on around you. That's how many games are portrayed. So, like in, say, Modern Warfare, you're a guy, the story progresses. You find some stuff, you know, that happens, the nuke goes off, you know, the story progresses. But you yourself, you haven't grown, you haven't progressed. There's nothing there that you're doing. You know, your impact on the game is as an observer. You may as well be a fly on the wall.
Right.
But this game, you were watching two people grow. And that was one of the things that really made me love the game. I think that's possibly one of the reasons why many fans of the series, of those, the Warrior Within and Two Thrones and Sands of Time, prefer Sands of Time to the other two, because it's much more of a kind of, there's like this whole thing of, I don't know, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, is that the story of the hero? There's a kind of certain academics have looked at the way that people tell stories throughout history, and there are certain themes that come through and certain characters that are usually portrayed, you know, and there's a certain progression, and that's universal to all of us, so we can all understand. So, like, if an alien came from Alpha Centauri, say, and they told a story of their heritage and their heroes and stuff, we wouldn't understand necessarily, because it would not be emoted in the same way that relates to us humans. We understand pain and suffering in the ways that we experience pain and suffering. So if we lose a close friend, we understand, we can empathize. That's the word I'm looking for. We have empathy to the way that things happen. And this story is told in the perfect way. It's like Star Wars. Unwittingly, although he did try to do it, but unwittingly, George Lucas made the original Star Wars the perfect action film.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, it hits all the right notes. It has perfect progression from start to finish. There are no lull points, you know what I mean, in the film where you think, okay, I wish to move on to the next part.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of action, but it's also, I mean, there's that game is, or not game, that movie is a classic hero class.
Exactly.
archetype,
and,
right?
And he actually says that he used this academic's research to make the story better. I can't remember.
Yeah, you're talking about Joseph Kemp.
Joseph
right?
Kemp, that's the guy. That's the guy. Yeah. And I have read his book, but there are other ones which summarize his kind of findings in a much more succinct way and a much more readable way, because he can be a bit obtuse in the way he puts things down. The Hero's Journey, I think his book's called, isn't it?
That's one of his books, Hero's Journey, The Power of Myth, I believe is the other one. Yeah. Other big one. I mean, probably read a bunch of books. But,
so what he was doing was he was tying in all the kind of the ancient myths to the modern movie-telling successes, even from things from Titanic to the Holmes Odyssey. And he was looking at how these things, I don't actually know, it wasn't, probably wasn't Titanic because he wasn't alive, I don't think, then. But the 70s films and stuff like that. Yeah, it's actually very interesting. If people get a chance, they should definitely read those books, because it improves your understanding of how the movie industry works. And you realize how you're being manipulated in certain ways to care about certain characters and not about other ones and stuff like that. It's really interesting. It's like sociology, really. But Prince of Persia had that, and it also had, I mean, very briefly, it also had the mechanics. And it wasn't a perfect game. The combat wasn't perfect, but it had enough that it worked. And the freeze, the best thing about it, apart from all this, was that it was entirely consistent. The game was entirely consistent. So when you died, the premise of the game was it was a story being told. So when you died, it was like, no, that's not how it happened. It's as if someone had interjected. So you know, when you're in normal conversation, people sometimes say, you know, what they think you're going to say next. I mean, I do it all the time. It annoys me to some extent. I try not to do it. But I understand that is, you know, the normal progression of conversation. So if you're telling a story, it's like, what's that one with the guy from Columbo and the kid from Wonderful Life?
Princess Bride.
Princess Bride, yeah, that's the one, yeah. And he's trying, the Columbo is trying to tell the story, and the kid jumps in with something like, "That's disgusting," or something, you know what I mean? It's like, do you want to tell the story or shall I? You know, and that's the way. Princess Bride is one of those kind of geek films, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, is told in that exact same tone. And I think that's why it hits such a watermark for so many people.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a very beloved game. And obviously, it's a console.
Yes. It's on PC as well, actually. It's not as good as on PC, though. I don't think it has gamepad support.
Yeah. We'd actually go play back and play something like that, though, because it sounds, you know, like the people who love it just adore it.
Yes.
So, you know, I can hear when you talk about it, you have a deep feeling of affection for the game. And you know, those games are, I'd like to, you know, play those games and see what the deal is about.
And they are, unfortunately, a bit of a product of the time as well. So the graphics and the interface and the combat is dated. But the story itself and the way it's composed isn't. It's like Master of Orion.
It's kind of a similar thing.
But I would say that it's not quite as perfect as Master of Orion. It doesn't progress through time as well.
Well, because it seems like the big knock, from what I remember hearing people talk about it, is the big knock is the combat is not, like you say, it has issues. And
I mean, for me, they were never bad. They never overcame the rest of the game. And it was never like you couldn't fight. In some games where the combat system just does not work as it's intended to. The combat system works, it's just not perfect.
Right.
And that's the only thing about it, you know.
Yeah.
So what's your next game?
My next game is...
Is it your final game or is it your penultimate game?
It's my penultimate game.
Okay, go on.
Okay. My next game is a little game called Fallout, the original game.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Where to get started on this game? This game affected me in a way that's...
I'm getting visions of you saying, this game made me a man.
This game made me a man. No, this game did not make me a man. I was already a man when this came out. But this game, I think the storytelling in this game is quite good. I think
it's unique.
I think really. I want to say it's unique. I want to say it's the first one, but it's not the first one to kind of be in that setting in place and try to do this sort of things.
But there was the what was it called?
Wasteland.
It wasn't quite the same, though, was it?
No, it wasn't the same. It was more modern, right, for the time. I mean, it's more graphically intense. You know, Wasteland was more of an old school, fixed, you know, kind of a almost, you know, it was one step above a graphical adventure game kind of game.
Yeah.
But this game was, you know, a turn-based tactical game at its core, but the world of the post-apocalyptic world was so well realized, at least for the time, right? That you know, there were so many things that you could do and get into and follow. And while it did kind of beat you over the head with a plot, right? You have a time limit on, you know, saving your vault's water supply. In the confines of that, and then once you get beyond that, you can go do pretty much whatever you want to do. And the game is to my mind, it's a little bit hard. It's quite difficult. And it's pretty brutal.
Yes, yeah.
In the sense that, but in a way that I appreciate.
In every sense, really, isn't it? It's in every sense. Brutal in every
sense. Yeah, it's probably brutal in every sense, yes.
From story and combat and interactions with other people.
Yes.
As we discussed last time, you know, if you make the wrong decision, and rightly so, you know, you're punished for it.
And to me, that's a characteristic of a game that I really appreciate is you can go get into, if you don't know what you're doing, you can get into a lot of trouble really fast. Mm. So you have to be more careful. You have to be more considered. You have to think about things a little bit more and decide if you're just going to go off and go wander the wasteland or go to a new city when you're really low level or whatever.
Oh, yeah, you're going to get absolutely spanked.
You have to decide whether the risk is, you know, the risk is worth the reward, right? Because sometimes you can carry it off and get some good loot and get some extra bottle caps.
Yeah.
Which will give you a definite leg up on the rest of the game, you know, that's more level, at your level. But the risk is extraordinarily high, right? I mean, and so you have to always kind of make that, what's that trade-off, right? Where's the comfort level there?
Yeah.
The second thing about the game, and I don't want to talk about it because we did talk about it last time, is just I think the plot is just top drawer. It's just so well done. It just you know, it's pretty serious. There's some humor in the game, but it's a pretty serious game. But you know what? Post-apocalyptic America, pretty serious place. Right? Not a whole lot of time for a lot of quality.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like with regards to the story, it's this kind of typical kind of 80s, late 80s sci-fi story.
Oh, absolutely.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, that the kind of subversiveness that's going on behind the scenes.
Yep.
You don't pick up until later on.
Yeah.
Things like Blade Runner and stuff like that.
I think one of the things I like about the plot is really that there's always this kind of undercurrent, but you never really, until about halfway through the game, you never really realize that this undercurrent is there, right? You don't really, and you can play the whole game without ever realizing that there is this kind of subversive undercurrent going on, but it's always there. You just never really see it until you just, at one point, you just kind of realize that, hey, you know, this is saying some interesting things, right? While I'm going around shooting mutants and crap like that. This is a great game. So what's your ultimate game or your last game?
Okay, so my last game in my top 10 was actually Chrono Trigger. So it's a game that's been on about 50 bazillion platforms.
I miss it on every one of them.
So you literally can't, it's impossible not to be able to play this game. And the definitive version is actually on the DS. So if you get a chance, you can actually go out and buy it right now on the DS.
Okay.
It shouldn't be too expensive. It came out a couple of years ago. I bought it and it combines the original game with the PS1 or I think it was the PS1 or Sega Saturn or something. They had the guy from Dragon Ball Z. He actually animated some of the scenes. So you get the animations as well as the normal kind of cutscenes in the game, and it's really good actually.
Mm.
Even watching it on the small limited DS screen.
So one thing that kind of turns me off from these games is, and I don't want to offend any of our potential listeners, but Japan it is, how anime it is. I've never been a big No, I should say even I've never been a fan at all. How's that? That's a better way to say it. Of anime or any of that sort of thing. You know, my book on anime sailed about Speed Racer, right?
I mean, and that's not a problem. I mean, some people don't like sci-fi.
Right.
Know, they prefer fantasy, whatever. You know, that is the kind of the danger of having such a strong genre, isn't it?
Right.
You know, and I know you're much more of also an RTS-er than you are an FPS-er, you know.
Right.
And that sort of thing. The thing that makes Chrono Trigger so good for me is that it's very like a Japanese version of Planescape Torment.
Oh, really? Those big words.
Yes. I completely agree. Chrono Trigger is to Japanese RPGs what Planescape Torment is to Western RPGs. It has a perfect story. It has undertones. It has depth of world. It has interesting characters you run into. It also has replayability because you're not playing the same game every time. If you can end the game within 5 hours.
Really?
Yes. Or you can end the game within 30 hours, depending on how you play it. Huh. You know, because you travel through time, you meet different things at different times. And because of the way you can combine your attacks with your comrades, I mean, there's few people in an active party, although you have more than those people to choose from. You have different abilities open to you. So it can really change the way you take on enemies, and obviously certain enemies are susceptible.
Okay.
So it's a different attacks and stuff like that. Yep. So, and also you don't necessarily get the set, you're not guaranteed to get the same comrades.
Huh. Right.
Depending on how you do it. So sometimes you can have, I mean, okay, some of them are guaranteed, but depending on how you always play through, you usually get Frog and you always have the Gadget Girl and the Princess.
Right.
But you don't necessarily get the other ones as well, depending on how you play it. And it's a game that allows you to explore.
Huh.
You know, it doesn't punish you for unlike in many of Final Fantasies, you're so railroaded that you don't have a choice. In this game, in Chrono Trigger, you can choose, or even though you don't realize you're choosing, you think you're following the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's choice that's masked, which is
That's
really, in my opinion, a brilliant choice.
Right.
The same as it is in Planescape Torment. You don't realize you're missing out on stuff.
Right. That is
all that.
That sounds very interesting. I might try to put away my prejudice against Japanese RPGs to give this a try.
To be fair, it is pretty different than most RPGs. You do, in my opinion. You don't have to grind.
Right.
You do some grinding naturally as you go through the game because you get random encounters. You can't avoid them,
right,
unfortunately. But if you just play the game, you don't have to stay in a certain area and sit there and grind.
Right.
Like you do in, especially Final Fantasy X and stuff like that.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons why Final Fantasy VIII is my favorite Final Fantasy game.
So I have to do that.
Because it's all leveled to you.
Right.
But yeah, it's I don't know. It's just it combines everything from story to progression to of your character and of, you know, your abilities. You also, you know, you upgrade your talents and also your weapons as well. And it's an armor, and it's typically seen as many, you know, Japanese RPG fans as one of the best instances of the genre.
Well, I might have to try that. Check that out. I might have to dig out the DS and go dig this up because you use some pretty strong language here, and you definitely got my attention at least.
I mean, you may not like it. I mean, it's not for everyone.
Right.
I mean, especially the turn-based battles can put a lot of people off.
I don't mind
because they are completely different, and I know I know there are other turn based things like you know XCOM and stuff like that. But they're turn based in a different way.
Okay. Well, so warned, but I might go dig this up. I might go see if I can find a copy of this. And
it should be fairly cheap now. It's been a couple of years since it's been out on the DS.
Right. Yeah. So that's cool. All right. Well, thanks for that. I'm actually looking forward to that.
So what's your yeah your final game?
Yeah, my final game is another game I played on the Commodore 64. It's called Pirates, Sid Meier's Pirates.
Yes. I played it both on C64 and also on PC.
Yeah, they remade this. Actually, they remade it a couple of times. And the last iteration, while it was okay, just did not, for whatever reason, recapture the magic of the original game. And I thought the PC port that they did was kind of poor as well.
Oh wow, okay.
And so,
because I loved the was it 2003 or 2004 version of it?
Yeah, I think it was 2004.
I played that to death.
Really?
You would have. It got stale after a long time.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
You're doing the same thing over and over
again. So, how was it different?
Well, so, and again, I couldn't get this. Obviously, I'm not going to get this to run. So, I might be remembering it incorrectly. But one of the things that they changed in the latest incarnation of this is they streamlined a lot of the things that, in my mind, gave a lot of character to the original game. And then they added a bunch of mini games. Now, in Pirates, the original Pirates, they had a couple of mini games, right? To be fair.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, the sword fighting was part of the original game, as it should be, right? You're a pirate, you're going to board some ships, and you're going to fight some sword duels. But the dancing mini game, for instance, was not present in the old version. And I thought the dancing mini game was the dopiest ass thing in the latest incarnation of the game.
Yeah.
The real-time battle stuff I didn't think was all that well done. It was interesting, but had a lot of issues. In the original game, you had your shore party, and if you marched onto a city, if I remember correctly, you would, if you had enough guys and you got some lucky die rolls, you would storm the city, and then you would fight the governor of the town, and if you won, then you won the day.
Oh yeah, right? you basically yeah.
You know, but really that's about all those two games kind of have in common, other than the Caribbean Sea. In the original game, you start out, you pick a period, and each period plays totally different from each other period. So, for instance, if you can pick 1560, which means that Spain is really really strong, and none of the other countries have more than maybe one port in the entire map. And so that game obviously is going to play quite a bit different from 1680, right? A century later, where Spain is really on the decline and almost kind of a non-entity, and all the other powers kind of have a lot more presence in the Caribbean, right? So, and then they kind of divides it up, you know, 1560, then they have like 1620, 1640, 1660, 1680. And each one of them gives you different starting conditions. And so
it makes a big difference. Because
it does make a big
difference. I know in the remake, it didn't really matter who you were.
Right.
Or what who you were allied with.
Right.
Because it was, you could basically assist in the takeover of any city pretty easily.
Right. Whereas in the original Pirates, and even in the latest incarnation, you know, who you start with and then who you ally yourself with has a big difference, right? Makes a big difference in the strategy part of the game. I mean, the game is really a strategy game that happens to have a couple of real-time, quick-time events in them. Well, not quick-time events, but real-time kind of events in them. But, you know, the beauty of this game is there's a level of kind of complexity. So, for instance, you can't really upgrade your ships, which I found a little bit hokey. It's like, if I spend some gold and, you know, I get better sales, I immediately go faster. Whereas in the original Pirates, you got a ship and it is what it was, right? You know, you got a bar, all the ships were kind of the same. And,
yeah, it doesn't really make sense to me that a cost and sale would do better than a, you know, whatever sale.
Right, exactly. And so they added some of that.
You're still pulling the same weights.
Right. And so they added some of these kind of things in there to give it quote unquote flavor, but I think they kind of missed the point in a lot of ways. You know, the sailing model in the latest one is a lot more forgiving than the original. I mean, if you had a couple of ships that were battered and you were up, you know, on the western side of Cuba it was going to take a hell of a long time for you to get back into friendly territory, depending on the time
you did. Yeah, the winds were very unfavorable.
Right. And you could, and I don't think the latest incarnation does this, but in the original, if you accidentally sailed into a storm, your ship could be damaged. So you really had to pay attention.
Yeah, it did happen. It was just, you had more time to get out of it.
Right. And this, sometimes you would just, a big storm would come up and you would, there's nothing you could do, which kind of modeled things more realistically, if you will. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, this game is, for me, I spent hours and hours and way too many hours playing it back in the day. I mean, graphically, it's going to look really bad, but at the time it looked really, really good. You know, you had kind of this sepia tone, overtones to a lot of things, and, you know, kind of make it look old-timey, or what they imagined old-timey looked like back in the, you know, early 80s. And, and just, I think overall, every piece of the game hangs together and supports each other a lot better than the newer one. You know, wooing, Governor's daughters was less,
In the new one, if you didn't interact with the governor's daughters, that was like a key game mechanic.
Right.
You could not progress.
Right.
Really.
Whereas in this, you could, and it really only, you know, it would, if you wooed a governor's daughter and ended up marrying her, you ended up with, obviously better faction relations for that country, and especially for that port, wherever the governor was. But you, it really, the goal of the game is to reach a point where you retire. And when you retire, it would rate you on how all the stuff that you did, how much money you had, and how much land. I mean, the governors would grant you lands, and you would go up the ranks. And
oh, okay. Because that was completely missing from the last one.
Right. And so the whole goal was to, you know, live through, because you could die. And you could, and I believe you could die in the latest incarnation, but you could die and that would be it. But you could also get to the point where you would retire, right? And the game would start giving you hints. You know, if you've been running around for 10 years being a pirate, the game would say, hey, you know, you're not quite as spry as you used to be. And you start
pushing your luck.
Yeah. And you start recruiting fewer and fewer crew because nobody wants to go with with an old guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So even though your reputation's really good,
they
still wouldn't go with an old guy.
They start, they start to not sign. You start signing up less and less, so it makes it harder and harder to keep going. And at some point, you just have to retire because you can't get enough crew to crew your fleet.
That is completely missing from the 2004 version.
And so the goal again, is to retire, and then it would rate you on how you did, and would give you a very awesome summary of all the things that you did throughout your career. Like, you know, you gained, you know, this rank with this faction and this many acres of land and this many, you saved up this many gold pieces and you married a governor's daughter. And depending on which one you chose, she could either be a, you know, vivacious and lovely creature or a plain dumpy, you know, woman or, you know, I think there was even some daughters that were, you know, kind of, never said this in the game, but you kind of got the sense that they were kind of, sleeping around on you and stuff like that. you know, like sharp tongued, you know, I don't know. I can't remember the exact terminology, but it was just, you know, going through and playing a whole career and getting to the end and retiring and having a great score was just so satisfying because, you know, you put all this time in. The other thing that really strikes me remembering back was in the New Pirates, and I'm not sure if I like this or not, in the New Pirates there's a lot of stuff on the map, right? There's always a monastery or an Indian camp or war canoes or everything.
You can wander around.
Right? I mean,
excuse me.
Sorry. Probably should cut that. War canoes are everywhere. And, and in the original Pirates, there just really weren't – it was a lot less – populated. I mean, you would, on the real map, it would just show you where you're sailing around, and every so often you would get a screen that pop up and says, hey, you see a ship on the horizon. Do you want to pursue or not? And if, you know, if you were able to catch him, then you'd go to battle. Whereas in the new game, you can see all, you know, if you have the line of sight, you can see all kinds of traffic going back and forth. And, you know, you can, no matter which island you go to, it seems like there's always something there, right? A pirate's cove or a, you know, Indian camp or long lost monastery or something. And in the, you know, the Pirates, it really made, when you went to an area that had a lot of civilization, it felt more don't know, the cities felt more isolated, like you would imagine they would have been back in the day. It didn't seem like there was, you know, there was some commerce going back and forth. You could see cities get, you know, go up in level as they got more trade.
That's right.
And, but, you know, but it really felt like you were, you know, on the ocean by yourself, with occasional interludes of combat and, boarding and slaughter, right? I mean, whereas, you know, in the new Pirates, you really can't swing a dead cat without a ship being around. And
it was much more action-y, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was much more of an action game than a strategy game, which is, this is really a strategy game at its core. I mean, you always had these interesting decisions to make. I mean, do you go after that ship? You don't know what it is, right? Is it?
That's right.
It could be.
And you wouldn't have like hints saying this is a well, I don't know if you did in the original one, but in the new one, it would say above the ship sometimes, this is like a payroll ship going towards
right.
Santiago or something like that.
Yeah, it didn't have any of that, so you wouldn't know. And so that made, like, for instance, I mean, they had a similar mechanic, if I remember correctly, in the new game, where you would get hints about where the treasure fleet was.
Yes, sir.
But you would have to go and try to, you know, work out and guess where the treasure fleet would be, where you could intercept it. And in the new game, I didn't really think that intercepting the treasure fleet was all that big of a deal. It was just
not
another
really,
thing
no,
to
because
do.
There was just attacking random fleets
right.
gave you enough. I mean, selling off ships and stuff like that, you ended up with more than you could use.
Right. Whereas in this game, it was a really huge deal if you were able to find the treasure fleet and take it out. I mean, as it was historically, right? I mean, the treasure fleet was not. Attacked by pirates that often, and the people who did it really made the reputation and were able to actually, you know, retire for all intents and purposes for piracy unless they really liked it. But, you know, so it was much more historically accurate, or at least the starting points were much more historically accurate. And the actions that you had to decide upon were obviously colored by the limitations of the technology and the fact that they're making a game that's supposed to be fun. But a lot of decisions you made were much more how you would imagine them to be historically accurate. Do I go and, you know, assault Panama? And, you know, what happens if I fail? And what happens if I try to get in there and they shoot up my ships? Or I get on land and I'm not able to take the town? What's going to happen next? And so you always had these, you know, like any good strategy game, you always had these decisions that you had to make at any given time about what to do next. And it was just, you know, just such a fantastically deep game that I think, you know, the new game really is much more of a shallow, venturesome sort of game that has a little bit of the trappings of the old original game. I don't know. Old guy. Take it for what it's will, but definitely one of my top games.
Get off my lawn!
Pretty much.
Okay.
So that's my last game.
Yes, so thanks for listening, guys. And we'll see you again next time. Hope you all enjoyed the show. And as we said last time, you know, if you do have your own top 10 games, email them into us at the.easiestbutton@gmail.com. And we'll compile them all together and we'll make like a meta, list and we'll put it as a post on the blog. So see you all later.
Yeah, y'all have a good week.